Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer at 3939 Lake Street and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777. Hello and welcome to Homer Grown. This is the third episode of the second season. Homer Grown is a bi-weekly show about gardening, agriculture, and local producers meant to encourage, educate, and empower gardeners. We strive to provide diverse voices by interviewing local experts and garden enthusiasts. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live and work on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. On this episode, we return to the garden for the first time this season. We talked to Tim Altimer, who is a local landscape company operator. We discuss asexual propagation methods, including using plant clippings, layering, and aerial rooting. We re-air a segment recorded last year, our very first interview for the show, actually, with Carrie Restino of Homer Hilltop Farm about seed starting, succession planting, and the challenges the pandemic presented in the first few months. And Nicole Arevalo has your weekly roundup of events and opportunities in local agriculture. Let's get started.
Sure. My name is Tim Altimer. I'm a local landscape company operator and garden enthusiast.
I wanted to talk about different methods of propagation, specifically propagation from clippings, but I'm wondering if you could talk about the different types of propagation for plants.
Sure. So most plants are usually propagated through a cutting, which can be anything from a new shoot to last year's shoot, but usually the tips are going to be your most likely to root. There's a procedure that's pretty common here called layering, that you can actually take a stem to the soil line and kind of tuck it into the soil and even put a rock or something like that halfway on the branch, and then roots will grow from that stem touching the soil. So that's called layering. There's aerial rooting, which is a little more involved, where you can score a little bit into the tissue of the stem and then wrap a bag with a little bit of sawdust in it and some moisture and bubble rubber band that around the stem. And then over time, that'll generate some root growth from that stem. And then there's also just direct rooting, which a lot of times people use a rooting hormone. Sometimes it's willow extract. There's all sorts of commercial products. And just dipping a soft cutting, kind of the tip, something that's before it turns the wood, dipping that and then putting that in soil.
So just to clarify, one thing that you talked about, I think you called it bubbling. And that's where you wrap kind of a bag. You sort of expose the inner part of the stem and then wrap a bag around it.
Absolutely, yeah. So just kind of peeling back that cambium layer, that very outside layer, to kind of get to the green color in the stem. And then having, yeah, a plastic bag, Ziploc bag, and just trying to get it sort of airtight. The whole idea is just to keep that moisture contained inside there, and then that'll spur this scar that you just did to shoot out roots.
What is the best time for these methods? Do you want to do it, you know, in the late fall, spring, early spring, towards summer?
I think a lot of things, spring and fall are the best, kind of when our heat goes away a little bit and you still have that frost-free time period, but it's not too extreme on the plant and it's kind of just thinking about rooting a lot. And that usually happens, you know, kind of first 2-3 weeks of break up to, you know, the last 3 days before we start getting kind of some freezing into the ground.
In some of the material I was reading, they talk about different methods for hardwood versus softwoods versus herbaceous. I'm wondering if you could talk about these or what the difference would be.
Yeah, so there is a lot of difference in the success rate with harder wood, just because you're asking something that has a little more either age or a little more sort of conditioning to be sturdy to kind of act like a new shoot. And so your soft or your herbaceous are going to tend to be a lot easier. For example, like mint, like imagine taking just a clipping of mint, most people, or jade, something like that is real easy to take. Whereas if you go to an oak tree and try to take a cutting from that and rooting that, it's going to take a lot longer and just need a little more time and effort to get that right. So for the, like your average gardener, your herbaceous, your new growth off of, say, oh, I don't know, thyme, anything like that is going to be pretty easy to root. Whereas, yeah, anything with some wood like your lilacs and stuff like that, they will root, but you're just going to have a little more optimum kind of rooting conditions and just pay a lot closer attention.
What do you do in order to propagate your plants? Is this a method that you use?
It is, and I tend to do it towards the landscape field or restoration. So every March I go out usually and we'll trim willow trees, take off last year's new growth, and I tend to hit spots hopefully that moose can't get to, although they're getting to quite a few spots this year. And then I'll leave those in a dormant sort of state, like anywhere from 40 degrees before, so they don't bud, but they don't necessarily freeze and dry up either. And then I'll go ahead and put them in a bucket of water and root them in water, and then put them in soil, and then use them for different restoration sort of things. I also do a lot of gooseberries and currants because they're very easily layered. That technique I said before, with kind of putting a branch into the ground, letting it root relatively within a season, and then you can kind of cut behind that point in the dirt and you got a new currant plant or a new gooseberry plant. They tend to do that naturally. They'll droop down and kind of touch, and if you're not on your currant bush, you probably already have a bunch of currants, you know, waiting to be cut and potted up and separated into a separate plant. So those are the plant material I tend to use the most of.
Yeah, I do the same thing, only I use those metal brackets. I guess those are called brackets. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't think
like kind of like staples.
Oh, yep. Yeah, they are. They're soil staples. Yeah. No, that's perfect. Yeah, I never thought about that. A lot of it, I do landscape maintenance, so I come across a lot of plants that need to be cut back and thinned. And so that's just tons of plant material, really. A lot of things here tend to grow pretty vigorously, and they tend to send out new shoots, or what I would call pups, like new kind of developments, even irises. It's good every once in a while to dig them up and break them into, you know, quarters or, you know, even more so if it's bigger, and then go ahead and start a new iris plant. So there's a lot of our perennials, especially in the spring and the fall, is the best time to kind of make more out of one instead of going to your local nursery, not to take away business. But there's a lot of perennials that can be divided and be just sort of enhanced for a new stock of plants.
You can still go to our local nursery and support it, and then provide little plant starts for your neighbors.
Absolutely.
In the future.
Yeah. And, you know, the only thing with that is to kind of keep away from the invasives. I think that's been a long Alaskan Oh, sort of trade is to kind of trade amongst your friends. And I know that's kind of how our Bergeri got around town pretty vigorously, which now is starting to become a little too aggressive. So just be careful of the plants that you do take and just kind of know that some of our plants really get pretty intense, and then you'll have a garden of just one plant.
So you had mentioned before about making a rooting compound out of willow, I think it was. Have you made this before, or could you share some of the steps in making that?
I haven't made it before, but I definitely know if anybody has been around willows in the growing season, there's usually a white milky sap that comes out of them. I think it would take quite a bit of time and effort to get a good amount, but that's basically what you're using is the natural sort of xylem, phloem, water, food storage that's in that willow twig and getting and secreting that out and just getting a container full of it. A lot of commercials, they use a little bit of that, but then they'll blend in other, and I don't even know what those chemicals are, but other rooting agents that will definitely help. But that willow extract is pretty heavily used within the rooting compound industry.
If I was going to take clippings or take cuttings, what part of the plant do I want to cut? How much do I want to take? And when would be the best time?
Yeah, good question. The easy answer is a lot's going to depend on the plant itself, but in general, there are some rules where you want to kind of take the newest of growth because that's going to have your softest, most vigorous tissue development in the plant. So therefore it can still kind of manipulate into performing root growth. Whereas if you take lower down on, say, a dogwood or something like that, it's probably going to be a lot harder to root that, say, half inch to 3/4 inch sort of diameter twig as it would, say, an 1/8 inch twig. That an 1/8 inch is just that much younger and more, able to be adapted to however you want it, rooting in this case. So that's definitely a good general rule for most plants is the new growth is kind of what you're going to want, unless it is a gooseberry or currant or something that has kind of naturally flopped down and rooted. That tends to be sometimes the first, second, even third year growth will do that and set out roots. Kind of forgot your question. Sorry.
How much to take and the
Gotcha.
time of year.
So I always like to do any even planting, any transplanting on a cloudy, rainy day if you can. It just really reduces the shock. If anybody's ever not taken enough roots or done it on a sunny day, they know plants can instantly wilt, which just means the leaves shrivel up and it just looks like, it hasn't had water in weeks. When really a lot of that, our sun is so intense. I really recommend doing it dusk, dawn, rainy days, cloudy days, like anything that kind of gives the plant a little bit of safety from that scorching sun. And once again, spring and fall tend to be the best daylight and the day best temperatures for our transplanting and grafting and rooting and all of those things I think are better done with not a full sun in the dead of summer ahead of you.
So one of the motivations for this interview is there's this really beautiful lilac tree that's outside of the KBBI studios, and every year it blooms, and every year I try to take clippings and don't have success. So I'm thinking that maybe my problem is that I take them when it starts to bud, and I'm not sure. Could you talk about the time as far as like the cycle of the plant goes, in spring, before it buds, after it buds, before it starts even getting green leaves.
For sure. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, with our winters, everything hits a period of dormancy. And that dormancy tends to start wakening up even a couple weeks ago, depending upon the year. Obviously, a lot of our birch syrup people, that's kind of when your xylem, when your water starts getting to go in the plants. And a lot of fruit tree pruning, a lot of like shape pruning and structural pruning, you want to do well before that. You really want the plant to be 100% dormant. So then it just doesn't react the first time it's alive to healing itself. And the dormancy, it seems to fool it to where it can kind of just kick off its spring growth and healing and all of that thing all kind of together. But definitely, you know, March, April, kind of when things are just starting to leaf out. I would almost say when the moose start eating the grass is probably a good time, because you should have a lot of those shrubs caged until then. The moose tend to hit things really late, and it's kind of when, you know, a lot of people are feeling spring and they want their cages to come down. So I would say when you start thinking about taking your cages down, the grass is maybe 6 inches high, you could probably start thinking about taking some cuttings. And it's a good time to kind of do your weeding around your perennials. And at that point, you know, you're already there. You might as well see if there's some dividing you can do, if there's some cuttings you can do, and kind of just do it in that early spring cleanup of your garden.
Is there any other things that go into the springtime maintenance of perennial plants?
Yeah, I like to do a really, really good weeding first thing in the spring. I really find that it's more of a management approach to weeding than it is for not having weeds in your garden in Alaska. So I tend to try to, and the soil is usually really nice and moist, so you can get the roots out, which is basically what I do when you're weeding. Equisetum is kind of its own thing. It tends to phase out towards the end of June, so you can do what you can with that. But
Equisetum, I'm going to guess that's horsetail, like equestrian.
Yeah.
Is that what it is? From the same root?
That is what it is, yeah. Yep, horsetail. For the rest of the weeds, it's really good to try to get a clean slate for that perennial first thing in the spring, and you'll really be happy that you did that towards middle and late fall when you do still have some weeding, but you got that initial really perennial stock of weeds kind of out and removed. I tend to like the deadhead as well. If I left things for the birds in the fall and in the winter, I tend to cut down grasses a lot of times first thing in the spring just to get all that even growth instead of kind of having a little bit of dead, a little bit of green. I just generally cut my ornamental grasses every year. So yeah, there's a lot of just sort of perennial cleanup that you can kind of do, just kind of shape. Give a good cutting if you didn't get to it in the fall, because really all the plants in Alaska are usually ready to pop in the spring. So it's nice to kind of deal with them and let them do their thing. And that makes me think of berry plants. I like to do those, you know, once again, before the flowers come out, just because that's your fruit. And a lot of, say, blueberries and stuff like that will flower before they leaf. And so you really want to get everything done with so you don't knock off any of those blooms that could be potential fruit. Yeah, and I guess the other thing you could do is bone meal, blood meal, you know, compost if you have it, a good wood chip mulching, just kind of doing your general like prep for the summer ahead. It's really nice to be able to do a lot of that stuff in the spring so you don't have to kind of interact so closely with the plant and just kind of set it up for the growing year.
I know you're out of state at the moment, but is there anything that you would be doing right now for your garden? Besides the things that you just mentioned?
I don't know what it looks like there, but in general, no. I've learned over the years, I've shoveled my garden, you know, and trying to think I could get out. And a lot of times it's just, it's a patient game. And it's really, a lot of times it's good to just wait. You'll compact the soil if you get out there a little too early and it's too mucky. So really, you kind of want to wait till we get some drying out of the breakup to kind of get out there. I think you can always do some above ground sort of, you know, tree pruning, shaping, cutting back alders, making some daylight if you see some branches that might, you know, be limiting some light to your garden, stuff like that. Well above the soil line is fine, but in general it's a lot of indoor stuff, I think, you know, for the seed starters out there.
You were talking about doing different things when it was more cloudy outside. Is that something that you would want to do if you were dividing plants or dividing the roots? You know, sometimes, you know, you have a plant that gets too big.
Yeah. So, you know, the spring and the fall, kind of just the season alone is kind of the equivalent of a cloudy summer day. And so I believe it's always better in the spring and fall to do stuff like that. Plus, a lot of times in the summer, you're busy doing other things. So you don't necessarily have to give your time and effort into doing that. Spring and fall are just ideal. You know, our moisture level in our soil tends to be just perfect where you don't have to water afterwards. So in general, you know, I've worked in garden in many places, and usually morning and evenings is kind of what you should do to just keep that shock, it's called, down. You know, it doesn't mean it's going to kill the plant, but if you're a commercial guy, you don't want owner to look at a wilting plant. Even if you're a homeowner, wilting plants are kind of a, you just worry about them. And so just having those clouds, having that moisture really allows things to almost just happen without it even kind of going through any shock. And so, you know, for the ideal conditions, the ideal like plant to just kind of get into its new home and start growing and not have to kind of go through that period of like what just happened to me, clouds, rain, it's all good.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Was local landscaper Tim Altimer. Coming up next, we have an interview with Carrie Restino, recorded at her farm up on Diamond Ridge on May 16th, 2020. While that is over a month away from today's air date of April 10th, and even at my yurt this morning, where there's still quite a bit of snow on the ground, as well as a 10-degree temperature, there's still a lot of relevant information as we begin planning and starting our summer gardens. So this segment now is almost a year old. It's interesting to think about just how much has changed within that last year. Interesting fact, this was the first interview we ever did for Homer Grown, and directly after the interview I got into a bicycle accident and broke several bones in my wrist. It's human nature to try to extract some meaning, especially when something happens seemingly randomly at the beginning of a project. If I could tie this back to gardening, I would say new beginnings present unforeseen obstacles. Be patient. Tend to your garden, whether that's a physical garden or the garden of your mind. Take care of yourself and work hard. Keep going. First, I just wanted you to introduce yourself and the farm.
Sure. I'm Carrie Restino, and this is Homer Hilltop Farm. We've got 15 acres up on Diamond Ridge. We've built this farm with myself, my two children, Liam and Taya, and a huge number of volunteers through the WWOOF USA program and friends who've come up and helped. It's definitely a community effort. We are now in our ninth year of production. We do about half of our production is greens. We're really well known for our salad greens. And we have also a CSA program that does weekly veggie boxes. And that's growing every year. Then we sell at Save You More as well for our greens production.
So because this first episode is about seed starting and kind of the transition in between winter and moving towards summer, I was wondering if you could give the audience a brief outline of how you begin preparing.
Sure. I think it's appropriate that we're sitting right next to a pile of snow while we talk about this. So we start our first starts in the end of January, and that's our tomatoes, leeks, and a few other items, especially flowers and herbs that take a long time to get to maturity. Then by the middle of March, beginning of April, we are planting 25 flats a week, and that's thousands of vegetable starts. So at this point, we've been planting now for months. How we go about our seed starting process is we use primarily ProMix, which is a mix of perlite and peat moss, and we moisten that, we put it in the seed packs, we mix in a little bit of blood meal, a tiny bit in the beginning, and start our seeds. The other thing we really work hard on is our soil temperature. So we make sure all our seeds are started in the house where it's 70 degrees, and we get much better germination that way. The other thing we do is we cover all of our trays with saran wrap so that the moisture stays in until they germinate. And then once they have germinated, we have racks and racks of lights that they go under in the beginning of the season. Then once it warms up enough, we have a nursery that we put them out in. Once they are showing their first true leaves, then we start to bring them out into the greenhouses to get them used to that climate. So I think with any starts, you're babying them. You want to give them the very best beginning life situation. So you don't want them to be stressed out at all. You don't want them to have not enough light. You want those lights to be right on top of your seed starts.
What kind of lights are these?
Oh, no, that's another detail question. I should be going to LEDs. I'm just using straight fluorescence shop lights, mainly because like anything in a farm like this, you start with duct tape and baling twine, and then you try and upgrade from there. So that's pretty much one of those things I haven't changed. And there's also a certain element of if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I tried some other potting mixes other than ProMix in the past and had complete crop failures. Don't know if that was why, but after that I was like, that's it. I'm only doing ProMix forever. Anyways.
So one of my first years gardening, I made the mistake of immediately putting the plants that were indoor with an indoor light outside without acclimating them.
Right. So if your plant has lived its entire life in your house under a light and you take it and stick it outside, even on a beautiful day like today, it will get not only sun shock, but wind shock. And you have to protect it against all that by easing it into the transition of being exposed to wind and bright sun and all this sort of stuff. So I start off, it sort of depends on the day. The best time to harden off your plants when they've are getting their first dose of hardened being outside is a cloudy, calm day. And you could put a plant outside in a cloudy, calm day for 2 or 3 hours and it would be fine. Then the next day, if it was the same kind of conditions, you'd leave it out all day. The third day, you might try leaving it out overnight. But you have to really watch those winds, especially. And then once you put your plants out into the ground, putting some sort of row cover cloth over them for the first week or so was really kind, you know. Lots of plants will live through all kinds of hardships, but they're not going to be as productive if you stress them in their first formative time.
When we were walking, touring your greenhouse or your high tunnels, I noticed that you had certain row covers specifically for plants that you said kept out the slugs.
You
maybe
mean
not slugs.
Yeah,
the root maggots.
The root maggots. Now that's a detail I do know. Yeah, so there are some times where you will use row cover to keep pests out. And it, especially with salad turnips and radishes, they get infested with root maggots really easily. So most people doing any kind of large-scale production of radishes or salad turnips keep the row cover on the plants from the time you seed them all the way through. That way the flies just never have a chance to lay those root maggots.
What are some mistakes that you have made in the past in regard to seed starting or transplanting?
Well, like I said, I have definitely made some big mistakes with using some different blends, and I wound up with one time I used fishbone meal in my starts and wound up with mold on everything. So I'm really careful about what I put in there to begin with. And then the second biggest mistake is just not watering consistently. When you have a tray of seedlings, the edge seedlings always get drier first. And if you're not watching really closely, the ones in the all the way back under those hot lights will dry out, and man, they'll be dead in like 2 hours if they don't get enough water. They're not very hardy at that age. So definitely trying to be consistent with your watering, but not overwatering, because if you overwater, the plant can't get any oxygen to its roots and it'll die. So how I teach my folks to tell if a plant is properly watered is by picking the actual seed pack up. And you'll gauge, you'll get so you understand what is too light, meaning it's way too dry, and what's too heavy, meaning it's over-watered and waterlogged. And I think that's the best way, because you really can't tell from, you know, if it's dark on the top, like it looks like it's properly watered, but the two-thirds of the seed pack is actually dry, bone dry, you can't tell that unless you pick it up.
And when we were walking around, you mentioned that you get a lot of your seeds from Johnny's.
Yep.
Do you have other places that you prefer to get your varieties from?
Yeah, Johnny's is like two-thirds of my seeds, definitely. Part of that is just you want to order from one place. I use Jung seeds. I don't know if actually it's Jung or Young. So Jung seeds for one variety of broccoli that I really like. And then high mowing seeds, I do a little bit from them. But I just universally like to use the varieties I've tried before, and Johnny's has been super consistent. Plus, they're based in kind of the same temperate climate as Alaska, and so I think they have good varieties for us.
Do you have any advice for a novice gardener?
I think that the key to success when you're starting out is to make things easy for yourself. You can do that by trying to keep the weeds at bay in a variety of different ways, using weed block, keeping Remay on things, and also making sure that you're not starting with soil that's really full of weeds. So trying to start off your beds clean. I would get your soil tested. That would be number two. And lime is probably the biggest thing. Our soils here are 4.3, which is super acidic. I was just offering some advice to a friend of mine up the road, and I said, you know, on this little bed that's maybe 20 by 20 garden, I would put probably 25 pounds of lime, and they were totally shocked by that. But that's my experience is, you know, for the first two or three years, you need to add a lot of lime every single season. So get your soils tested and then follow those recommendations to a T. And then the third thing is get a really great water system going. Buy yourself a little timer, set up the hoses, set up some sort of irrigation system, whether it's T-tape or anything like that. Because we all have tons of energy this time of year when we're putting things in the ground and it's all great and wonderful. But then our lives get busy. We're fishing, we're doing this, we're doing that. And if you don't have a good system in place, your best intentions are going to get eaten by slugs and overgrown by chickweed. And so do it right to begin with.
So you operate mostly off drip lines. Mm-hmm. with a timer.
Yeah, we have a lot of timers. Yep.
We were talking about the irrigation system and you were talking about the grant from the
NRCS. So there is a program. It's pretty extensive. You have to monitor your water levels, your soil moisture levels, on a daily basis throughout the life of the grant.
Was it one specifically for water?
Yeah. It's a water conservation grant. So the idea is to try and use as little water as possible. So you're trying not to overwater things. But they actually designed a whole system for us, for this farm, which has, you know, 500 feet of main line and thousands of feet of irrigation drip line. So it's pretty complicated stuff.
A lot of the world right now is kind of different because of COVID-19. Has anything changed in regards to your gardening this season as opposed to another one? Or are there any challenges that you are facing or fears that you have?
Well, the big thing that has changed is that people have woken up to the issue of food security in a way that I could not have imagined could happen that quickly. I think just seeing bare shelves at the grocery store made people realize that their local farmers are really, really important. And it's been so heartwarming because this is something, you know, that I'm obviously very passionate about, or I wouldn't spend every waking hour working on this farm. It's wonderful to see so many other people starting to recognize what's going on in the world. The thing about this year is people started calling me in March wanting to get on the Veggie Box program. We have two more shares left, which is crazy. We've never been sold out like this. We always sell everything, but I've never had this much advance interest. We've had to do a lot more online stuff. We got a new website and are doing online sales so people can pre-order for the farmers market and also doing delivery. So all those components will take some time to figure out, and they're all new, and trying to figure out how to use credit card systems and stuff is all new. And anytime you're doing something for the first time, it takes 10 times as long. And as far as being a small-scale farmer in this particular climate, you know, we are so lucky to have the support of the community. We're really feeling buoyed by that. The only real frustrations I've had are all of our, sometimes we've used volunteers from the lower 48 who've come through, and that is completely no go. We can't do that this year at all. So that's a shift, but it was one that we were already kind of headed in that direction anyways. But I hope, you know, to return to that too, because educating people about small-scale agriculture is part of what we're doing here, so.
This is a little off the topic, but kind of just a personal question that I'm curious about is your high tunnels, instead of having a vent on the doors, you have vents on the sides where you manually use a pulley system.
Yeah, they call it drop-down sides instead of roll-up sides, which most of these tunnels will come with roll-up sides. We got our first one from FarmTech, had the drop-down sides. And I love that so much for our climate, especially when we put those plants out there in the beginning of April. It's very cold outside and it can get 80 degrees in the tunnel and you need to cool things off a little bit, but you don't want to hit them with a 30 degree breeze. You know, the day breeze picks up and your little plants are getting frostbite. So having the drop down sides allows airflow to fluctuate through the tunnels without actually blasting the little plants. So it's really good for the shoulder seasons on both sides.
What are you excited about for this season?
I'm just excited that so many other people are excited about local food and local food production. I mean, it is so wonderful to produce food for people who really appreciate it. And there's lots of those people in the community always, but there seems to be way more now. Oh, can I say something about succession planting?
Yes.
Okay. So I hear again and again from people, there's a really funny flow at the farmer's market. Lots of people, pretty much most of the people who go to the farmer's market, have a garden of their own. And because we sell so many greens, I see this. There's a point in late June, early July, where our green sales at the farmer's market drop off quite a bit. And I know that all of a sudden people's veggie patches are producing lettuce, right? Wonderful. And then the third week in July, usually when it starts to get rainy, our green sales jump through the roof all over again. And it's because their lettuce starts have either gone to seed or got eaten by slugs or are just old and bitter. So one of the things that we do here at the farm is we continually start lettuces and some other things too. Even peas you can do a couple of succession plantings on. So we're starting, but with the lettuces specifically, we are planting 7 successions throughout the year. So we are planting new lettuce starts every 3 weeks. It's hard to remember, so maybe stick it in your phone or something like that to just get out there and throw a couple more seed trays together, because you won't be able to buy them at the greenhouses. They stop selling, so you're really pretty much on your own to get those late season. And so you can plant lettuces every 3 weeks, and then the last planting you need to plant your starts around the beginning of August. So you'll start some starts at the beginning of August, you'll plant them out the middle of August, and that if you do a bunch at that time, if we get a fairly mild fall, you can have kale, chard, lettuces of all varieties. They'll withstand all the way down to like 25 degrees, especially if you put some row cover over them. So then you extend your capacity to have greens coming out of your garden for months by doing that. So that would be my one big piece of advice, is to keep keep starting.
How do people keep their lettuce from bolting around the solstice?
Well, therein, I mean, you could try using shade cloth. I just replant. Yeah. And also, you know, if you have anything in any kind of a covered situation, you want to start moving it outside definitely by the beginning of June. We transition all of our greens production from the tunnel to the outside gardens and then back in again because it's too hot in a covered situation.
That's why all your greens in the high tunnel were so close together, because you're going to thin them out by taking them into the field?
No, that's just how you plant greens in a large scale. You want to keep them short and small. They're not going to get big. The big head lettuces and stuff are 4 rows every 6 inches, but that stuff is 12 rows every, I don't know, half an inch or so.
So it's the difference between a commercial grower and a casual gardener.
Yeah, yep. I mean, that's a dense seed. You're just one step above, you know, microgreens, basically. You're not shooting for anything. And those will get cut 2 or 3 times and then replanted, or that will leave the bed until later in the summer.
Can I ask you, what is a Jang cedar, and do you use one?
Yeah, so we have 2 cedars that we use. One is the Jang. Some people call it the Yang. And we use that. It's a precision cedar, but it's a single row cedar. So for our greens, it's not the best, because trying to fit 12 rows through a single row cedar and have it be properly spaced is pretty tricky. So for those greens, we usually use a 6-row cedar. And the 6-row cedar, you just pull it behind. But it's a little more finicky. You have to have a very perfect seed bed. You can't have a bunch of rocks or roots or clumps or anything like that.
Is it a manual?
Yep. Yeah, but both of those tools are pretty expensive. For a small scale, you know, anybody doing their own gardening or anything like that, you probably wouldn't want that investment. This farm, they just barely make sense at this scale. But you can go out and densely seed your greens like I have there. If you're just doing 10 feet just by, you know, kind of evenly shaking them out, and you'll get great density that way. So for us, having them perfectly spaced not only is really nice to look at, but it also allows us to use a cultivation tool to run right between each row so we can knock down the weeds. And if they don't have perfect row, you can't do that. You have to hand weed, which takes time, thus making it not financially possible to survive. But yeah, the Jang is an awesome tool. They now sell a 5-row Jang, which is what everybody's using now. The 6-row cedar is getting kind of obsolete because it's so persnickety. It has to have perfect soil. Basically, like if you bought compost, you know, like fishy peat or something that's perfectly clean and laid it on there, that's has to be compacted, but not too compacted, not too wet, not too dry.
Is it Jang, just spelled J-A-N-G?
Yeah. A lot of these tools come from Asia, small-scale gardening. You want to start anything that you wouldn't want to direct seed anything that you could wind up with 20% germination failure. If you do it in a tray, then once you transplant out, you've got 100% of your space used. If you direct seed and you don't get perfect germination, which you rarely do, you've lost a whole bunch of space. It's just efficiency. For that stuff, you have to direct seed. It would take a really long time to transplant all that stuff. And carrots, you have to direct seed. We use the Jang for the carrot. It's we've done a lot of tooling up here in the last couple years. I'm not sorry. It's really made life a lot easier. We have this awesome quick cut greens harvester. It's like a little mowing machine. And then we have this flame weeder that's got like 5. It goes like, it's awesome. Liam always likes to use that, my son. He's 16.
Can you briefly describe flame weeding?
So creating a stale seed bed is something that's really important anytime you're direct seeding into the soil instead of using transplants. Although you could do it when you're transplanting in as well. So the idea is you create your garden bed, put your amendments in, tilth it, do everything except plant it, and then you water it, and then you wait, usually 10 days at the least, depending on the temperature. Once the chickweeds and grasses that are inevitable in our soil germinate, you come along with either a flame weeder or use a tarp to smother the seeds. And so what you're doing is you're germinating all the seeds that are in the top couple inches of your garden bed, and then you're killing them. And then you plant into that carefully. You don't mix the soil up. You don't mess around with anything that you don't have to. You just make your rows, you seed and water things. And that gives your plants a jump start. So they'll have at least a weed-free existence for like 2 or 3 weeks, or at least a low weed pressure situation. So by then, those, you know, say it's carrots, for example, the carrot tops will start to shade out the ground and the weeds will be less able to thrive. And so that's the perfect situation, is to just have a weed-free first few weeks. In carrots' case, be more like a month or month and a half, if you can, so they don't have any competition.
You don't want to transplant root vegetables.
I even transplant radishes, but I don't transplant carrots because they get wonky. I did it 1 year thinking I'd have these dancing carrots, because, you know, if you have the first carrots of the year at the market, it's you're the god, right? And I thought, kids will love dancing carrots. One problem with dancing carrots, it takes hours to clean a carrot that's all...
Oh, like when you plant them close together and they get intertwined.
Exactly. Well, if you transplant a carrot, they are all funky. They are like... They look like they've been through an earthquake. So you're like hand washing every single carrot individually. So that was the end of my dancing carrots adventure. It was a good idea, though. It's all an adventure, you know, like one of my employees, Kimber, was asking me, have you ever had any crop failures? And I just started laughing because every single year there's things that I experiment with or different conditions cause certain things. And just every year you learn another layer of experience to add to the other layers of experience. And I think about the great farmers like Elliot Coleman, and he's been doing this for probably 40, 50 years, and he's still coming out with new tools and new ideas and new strategies for dealing with things. You can never stop learning when it comes to farming, which frankly is kind of why I love it. It is the ultimate challenge. Speaking of which, I should probably get back to work because this is one of the few days where I have space and time.
And so. Sun. It's
and
so nice.
Sun. It's gorgeous, I know. Anyway, but thank you for doing this program. It's really great to get more people inspired to farm, and there's certainly lots of interest in it this year. If I had 5 minutes for every person who calls me asking for advice, I'd use up days and days and days.
A lot of it is just wanting to know what I'm doing wrong and hoping that other people don't make those mistakes. And that was Carrie Restino, recorded at her farm on Diamond Ridge on May 16th, 2020. Listening to that interview makes me miss the heat of the sun and watching plants grow so much. Coming up next, Nicole Arevalo has your weekly roundup of events and opportunities in local ag.
Hi, I'm Nicole from Homer Soil and Water with this week's roundup of news and tidbits on local agriculture and wild habitat too. First up, there are many good online workshops happening this month, starting with webinar watch parties. The Homer Soil and Water staff have been sleuthing out some of the best webinars that can help local farmers with technology-based supports they can utilize for their farm business. However, many of these will be applicable to other folks too. Each will offer Alaskans an opportunity for discussions with people knowledgeable in each topic. On April 13th, Social Media 101. This will be an hour chock full of great advice geared especially for farmers, but is really for any busy people who would like tips on how to navigate having a good social media presence for their business without getting lost in the weeds. Then on April 21st, online farm sales platforms. On April 28th, phone apps for farmers. And on May 5th, touchless payment options for people who'd like to sell the food they grow, or anything really, without handling cash. No pre-registration is necessary. Find the links to these talks on the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District website or on our Facebook page. And there are two Know Your Land talks this month. On Tuesday, April 20th, Weed-Free Hay and Invasive Plants, Keep Alaska Wild and Free, with Homer Soil and Water's Invasive Plants Manager, Catherine Shakey. And on Tuesday, April 27th, Small Acreage Pasture Management, with Karen Sonnen from the USDA NRCS Homer Office. Both will be held online via Zoom. Find the links to participate on the Homer Soil and Water website or our Facebook page. The UAF Cooperative Extension has quite a few interesting webinars that are free and open to the public. On April 12th and 19th, 4-H Youth in Governance, open to non-4-H youth. On April 15th, Birch Tapping and Syrup Making. On April 21st, the Produce Safety Alliance Grower Training. And also on April 21st, Pollinator Gardens. And April 21st is also the start of the Spring 2021 South Central Alaska Master Gardener Class. This will be a full course with multiple sessions throughout the spring. Registration and more class details are available online at uaf.edu/ces. And if you're interested in being a farmer's market vendor at markets in the central Kenai Peninsula, the application period is now open for the Soldotna Saturday Farmer's Market, the Soldotna Wednesday Market, the Farmer's Fresh Market at the Kenai Peninsula Food Bank, and also the Monday Market at Nikiski Hardware. Information for these markets can be found at the Kenai Local Foods Connection website at kenailocalfoods.org, or you can email me at nicole@homerswcd.org, and I'll get you the contact information. Here's something exciting. The Homer Seed Library is officially open. There are over 4,000 packets of vegetable and herb starts available inside the foyer at the Homer Public Library. A seed library lends out seeds for folks to grow with, and then the borrowers are asked to save some of the seeds from their crops to return to the library for future seasons. You do not need to save seeds from everything you borrow. The seed library team just asks that you find a few things you can learn to save. The idea is to increase our community food resilience by enabling people to grow more food, encouraging a community of seed savers, and developing a living collection of seeds that are adapted to our climate through local cultivation from successful plants. Membership is free, as are upcoming workshops. If you'd like to check it out, you can visit the Homer Seed Library, join the Homer Seed Library Facebook group, or contact Saskia Esslinger at alaskasaskia@gmail.com for more information or to volunteer. And did you know that there's a phone app out there that's all about community compost? It's called Share Waste, and what it does is connect people who wish to recycle their kitchen scraps with their neighbors who are already composting, worm farming, or keeping chickens. It's a cool way to divert waste from the landfills while getting to know the people around you. Find out more at sharewaste.com. And lastly, just a reminder that the NRCS's Conservation Innovation Grant deadline for applications is coming up on May 14th, and that applications are ongoing for their Conservation Stewardship Program in Alaska, which offers money to growers to take care of their land while growing food for their family or community. And if you're curious about their High Tunnel program, NRCS has also created new outreach materials for that. Contact the Homer NRCS office at 235-8177 to get those materials, or email me and I'll send you the link.
And that's the show. I want to thank Tim Altimer for talking to us about plant propagation methods. Also to Carrie Restino of Homer Hilltop Farm for talking to us about seed starting and succession planting. Local musicians Carly Konomak, Kevin Cope, and Ryan Black for contributing their music to this episode. Thanks, as always, to Nicole Arevalo for everything that she does. Questions, comments, or if you want to trade some plant clippings, you can email Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer. Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer at 3939 Lake Street and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777.